Well, good morning, everyone. It's a great privilege to be here. My name is Mark Bratton. I'm the director of St. John Baptist Birkswell, and have been for 3 years. An outstandingly beautiful and historic church located a mere 6 miles away from where we're standing, and to which you're warmly welcome to visit it any time within bounds of reason. And on my right is Jill Bailey Tompkins, who's a resident of Birkswell and has a background, intellectual formation as a historian, as indeed I have, and becoming rector has brought me back to my first love. We will present for 20 minutes and then we'll have 10 minutes for questions and answers, and I think that will probably be the most valuable part of the session. But when I became rector of St. John Baptist 3 years ago, I don't think that I fully appreciated the significance of what I was taking on. I came having been university chaplain here at Warwick University, and was suddenly faced with the task of growing and deepening a thriving village parish church. And it became clear to me as I got more deeply involved in village life that there appeared to be a disconnect. I mean, although it was very difficult for me to distinguish my congregants from people who were members of the village community, because there seemed to be a real porousness between church and community. Nevertheless, there was a not insignificant constituency within the village, you know, who made it politely but firmly clear that they felt no sense of ownership of or connection with the church. In addition to that, the church being the church drive, forming part of the Millennium Way, the church has a lot of visitors, a lot of what I would call secular pilgrims who are interested in church architecture, looking for a place to be silent and to contemplate. But I also became aware that there were a lot of people, and perhaps I'm reading too much into this, who would stop outside the church, cogitate. You could tell that they were thinking whether or not they should enter, and then deciding at the last moment not to, as if they didn't feel a sense of permission to enter. And I was deeply struck by that. Where does this sense of a lack of permission come from? Well, there are complex sociological and historical arguments relating to that. I'm conscious of some of David Hay's sort of empirical theological work, and he argues that while there has been a decline in religious commitment, there has been a corresponding rise in people who are prepared to own up to some sense of spirituality. But even those people who would call themselves spiritual rather than religious nevertheless evince a degree of alienation from religious institutions. So I wanted to reflect on that phenomenon a little more deeply, to try and enter into that disjunction between church and village community, church and a significant number of visitors who would bypass the church. And what struck me most forcibly was that this sense of alienation from the church, this disjunct between church and community, would probably have been incomprehensible to most of the church and village members throughout most of the church's history, because the very fabric of the church itself bears the imprimatur of the changing needs, conditions, and situations of the church itself throughout its long history. For example, the school began in the first floor room of the 16th century porch. Generations of local families are buried in the churchyard. Building itself stands physically and metaphorically at the historic heart of Birkswell, holding the collective memory of the community in its fabric, its records, and its monuments. And I felt that it was important to set the story of faith represented by the buildings and the congregation through the centuries in the broader context of the church's community life, and to explore creative new ways of telling the whole story of Berkswell in partnership with the wider community. And in that connection, we set up a Spirit of Berkswell working group, which contains not only members of the church congregation, but people drawn from the wider community who have an interest in history and doing some local historical research. I will now hand over to Jill, who will tell you a little bit more about the history of the church itself. But just to end off this little section, I suppose as a parish priest, what I feel I'm engaged in is not simply reconstructing the history of the church in its broader community context, but engaging in a kind of soft mission, trying to persuade people, actually, that the church is not apart from the community, but has always been a part of it, and that people ought to feel a sense of ownership and connection with the building, even though they themselves may not be religiously observant.
Okay, well, this is a sample of the sort of material that will be available on our website or phone apps, whatever we get to finish with. And so just to give you some glimpses into Berksville's past, I've got four somewhat random topics. There's a Saxon, a Norman, a Tudor, and then one from 19th and 20th century. So first, the Saxon era. It has been suggested that the name of the village is the contraction of the personal name Berkel and the village well, hence Berkswell. It is conjectured that Berkel was a local leader who was converted to the Christian faith through the preaching of missionary monks from Lichfield. But you can see that the well was very suitable for total immersions. As Dugdale said, it boileth up. A lot of water used to go through. Unfortunately, not now. Berksville would have lain in the Kingdom of Mercia. And there was an interesting thing happened in 749 AD, where Berkel signed a document that was drawn up by Ethelbald that freed this area from taxes for the salvation of my soul and the stability of my kingdom. Mercia was to be free from all secular services and also secure from all burdens, major and minor, until the end of the world. It was quite a good start, I thought, for the church in this area. Whether this same Berkel, who was said to be baptized in the well at Berkswell, is the same fellow, we don't know. But it does show that in Mercia at this time, the church had an influential hold on the leaders. This power came from fear of the Pope's ability to condemn a soul to hell for being dissolute and irreligious, a criticism that had been levelled at Ethelbald. So now we're leaping forward just 300 years to when Berkswell's St. John Baptist was built. It's around 1150, during the tempestuous times of King Stephen. The nave was built above a Saxon structure. There's a part of a Saxon wall that you can see in our crypt. It probably provided a one-room church with apse behind the chancel. But within the next 100 years, the crypt was enlarged and part of the north aisle and the chancel were constructed. And structurally, they remain pretty much the same today as they were in the 13th century. The main difference is the height and light into the nave now, because in the 17th and 18th century, they added clerestory windows and went up. But of course, it would have been very different inside. Mainly the interior decoration would have been different. With painted walls. There's a little vestige of painted walls down in the crypt, actually. And there would have been candlelight or sacred images. and the nave at some time was separated from the chancel by a rood screen. We know from written records that the rood screen was still being lit by a beeswax candle in 1546.
Well, there we are. There's the nave.
Ah, sorry.
There is the chancel, and that's the exterior east end.
Right, so the massive sandstone church must have really stood out in the parish because there's no evidence of any other structure to compete with this building. The de Mandevilles held the lordship of the manor, but it's likely that the lords of the manor did not live in the parish until the 17th century. We don't know how many people this church served. Birkswell is in the Domesday Book, but it appears twice with conflicting figures, so it's not very helpful statistically. Sometime in the 14th century, when the plague reached England, a new bell was made by Johannes de Stafford and brought here. The north aisle was extended, the south aisle added, and this might have been a chapel to say extra prayers for whoever paid for this addition, although there's no record, we're not listed as having a chantry chapel as such.
Yes, we can't see the north aisle there, but you can see the south aisle.
You can see they're the later arches because they're the pointed ones, the earlier ones are rounded on the other side. So now we go through to the Tudor times, when the porch was built. The population in 1525 has been estimated at 384. It's, of course, a guesstimate. And the parish size was perhaps 6,000 acres, 2,000 of 8 acres of which belonged to the Lord of the Manor. It was a dispersed parish with settlements not particularly around the church, but more around inns and closes. So you've got Nailcote Inn, Beach End, and Burton Green, and Carroll Green. And it's still really quite like that today, isn't it? It hasn't got a very big village centre. The room above the porch was used in the 16th century, as Mark said, as a schoolhouse and as a meeting for the parochial vestry. In this room, once a year on Easter Monday, the vestry met to elect their church wardens. The parochial vestry included the rector and all those members of the parish who were rated for the relief of the poor. However, Birkswell seemed to have a select vestry that was self-perpetuating from among the wealthier in the community. And these are the ones that made the decisions. The church wardens had an income at their disposal from the rents from properties that had been donated over the church for the past 200 or 300 years. And sometimes this fell short of expenditure. And sometimes the church wardens themselves donated the money to make up the shortfall. But it also should be noted that there were several who appeared in court in Warwick because they appeared to have pocketed the shortfall, and they were made to pay it back. But it's also inferred that that wasn't actually intended, that it was more due to messing up their account books. Some samples of things they paid for. There's the schoolmaster's salary. There's mounts to mend the tiles in the church, new bell ropes, pointing of aisles, mending the leads of the church. Goes on, there's bell ringers paid to commemorate Elizabeth I's coronation day. There's also some money for the mending of the courthouse floor, which is a little interesting because we had thought maybe the church was used for the courthouse, but that would sound like it was a different building, but we have no idea where the manor court was held. And then there's Wootton, who kept to keep the dogs out of the parish. Then there's some charitable payments. Widow Wharton and carrying out of town a poor soldier. But yesterday, Professor Dyer mentioned that the charitable payments at this time were not a large feature of the church warden's accounts. And this is borne out in Birkswell, because averaging figures from 1602 to 1616 and 1618, the annual income was about £10. The largest expenditure was the salary of the schoolmaster, 54%. Then it was followed by rent to the Lord of the Manor for 14%, and I'm not sure what that's for. Repairs to the church, 12%. School and property repairs, 3%. Legal fees and administration, 8%. And charity, 2.5%. Bread and wine, 2%. And other items, 1.5%. It's quite interesting just what they actually did, really. The church wardens were more kindly than the manorial. It was a court baron that was held at the same time. They were saying things like, no tenant or under-tenant shall take in any tenant unless they are able to support themselves, without relying on public relief, on pain of 20 shillings. And it's very personal. Henry Palmer shall remove his mother-in-law Howells and a bastard from his house before the feast of St. John the Baptist, next, on pain of 20 shillings. No tenant to take in any lunatic to live with them, on pain of 20 shillings. None shall take in any lewd woman of ill conversation or being with child, on pain of every default, 40 shillings, half to the Lord and half to the poor box. So they were not very charitable. It was, so it wasn't, you can see that it was, by our standards, really very mixed up, the religious and the secular activities at this time. So lastly, I'm jumping to a topic in the early, from the 19th to the 20th century, and to give an idea of just how this project will range, I focus now on Birkswell rectors. In this, so at the end of the 19th century, you've got the 1894 Local Government Act, which takes a lot of functions out of the realm of the vicar and his vestry and puts it into local councils. But socially, the church remains the centre of the parish. And rectors had long tenures in Birkswell, often till the end of their lives. They were well known, lived in great houses, and were often great characters.
Yeah, that could have been mine before 1954.
Yes. So the Reverend Cattell, is that how you say his name?
Cattell.
At Birkswell was such a figure. He was so keen on fox hunting that he was only comfortable in the saddle. So he had a hobby horse stool, at the expense of the church wardens, I might say, specially made and installed for him to preach from. Then later there was Henry Watson, who was a very keen mathematician and seems to have put all his energies into running a boys' school from the rectory. He actually was the father of Maud, the first ladies' Wimbledon tennis champion. In the early 20th century, there was Hugh Black, who was back, who was so fond of motorbikes that he rode his bike up into his house, the dignified Queen Anne-style rectory, and kept much of the ground floor as a mechanic's garage for his beloved bikes. This building during the First World War was used as a hospital for the British sick and wounded, with Maud Watson, whose father by then had died. She was the organiser and the matron in charge. In 1955, the church commissioners sold the rectory, which is now called the Well House, and the Victorian extensions, which Watson added for his boys' school, were demolished. And so the more modest modern-day rectory, which Mark lives in, it's very pleasant.
We've got 3.7 acres of garden and spinney, so I'm not complaining.
Sheep and ducks.
Yes, it's a small hobby.
So it does really rather reflect the changes that have gone on through the 20th century to the church and its parish.
Well, I'm having, or the church, or the diocese now, is having an amicable dispute with Philip Jagger, who now owns Well House, a former conveyancing lawyer about the ownership of the wall, which was part of which was destroyed in the recent great wind of Berkswell. But I can tell you more about that privately. Just to end the presentation, bringing it up to the 21st century, that is the Jordan Room. We built an annex that was added on to the medieval building in 2004. It was completed in 2004. It was the subject of considerable controversy, as you might imagine. It was built after 10 years of protracted negotiations. There were a large number of villagers, people who otherwise had no connection with the church, who were adamantly opposed to the idea of the extension. And they were only eventually won over by some fairly labour-intensive work by two members of our congregation who visited 200 homes in order to explain the rationale for the project. And I have to say that it's utterly transformed the social life of the congregation, and this is just a little snapshot of the way that it has. That is the Jordan Room. Upstairs we have the Burkle Room, and we've got some church officers as well. And I think it's worth reflecting on the reasons for the opposition. It was this strong, visceral response to the idea of there being any change to the fabric of the church. It brings to mind the old joke, you know, how many Anglicans does it take to change a light bulb? Change? And it seems to me that Berkswell's interconnected history makes it clear that the right question to ask people is not whether or not there should be change, but if there is to be change, then what form that change should take, in the light of the incontrovertible fact that Berkswell Church has changed throughout the centuries in response to the changing needs, condition and situations of the local community. So the question I would put to people now is, in the light of the fact that there has always been change in Berkswell, what forms of change do you think would be appropriate in the current context? It's a slightly different, more challenging question to put to people. And I think that this problem highlights an important but crucial distinction between what I would call tradition and traditionalism. Tradition being that dynamic narrative force which is nourished by the past but which is ever making all things new, and traditionalism being dead weight. I can't source the quotation, but the great church, Yale church historian Yaroslav Pelikan, define tradition as the living faith of the dead and traditionalism as the dead faith of the living, a distinction I rather like. So just to conclude, if the spirit of Berkswell Project can reconnect the church, the community and the wider world to its shared past and to each other, I believe it will have more than served its purpose. There we are. We've got 5 minutes for.
Thanks for this very fine contribution. You pointed out a different, very different layers in one spot there. This is the advantage of having a church here and with different periods, all in the same place. Immediately open it up for discussion for your questions.
I just wonder, have you got a picture of that extension from the outside?
Well, you can see it on the first one.
Oh, probably missed it.
They weren't here.
Yes, right. That's the,
there we are.
On the right.
That's it. And these are the church offices. Oh, that's the kitchen, and then you've got the Jordan Room there and the Burkle Room.
Well, you've done a jolly nice job to blend it in with the church.
Well, yes, I mean, I can't take any credit for that because it was before my time, but
good church architect.
Yes, wonderful. I think it blends in very well.
It's joined into the church, is it?
Yes, yeah, it's through the north door. There's a north door, north aisle.
Yes, it's a north, it's one that goes through one of the original arches.
Yeah.
Romanesque
style.
It's this Romanesque building.
Yeah, well, yes, the earliest extant parts of the Church of Norman, 1150. There was probably an Anglo-Saxon predecessor. It said that that octagonal crypt is on the footprint of an earlier Anglo-Saxon structure.
It's quite funny because a 1884 archaeologist did some looking at the building carefully, and he was very disgusted with the quality of workmanship in the original walls, which is quite funny since it's still absolutely standing.
You've got far more important things to do now than revisit the recent past. But just looking at that photograph, I reflect on two parishes in southwest London, which were both the subject of arson attacks in the 1970s. One of them went for a fairly massive rebuild involving the destruction of some of the outer walls. And that caused almost riots in the community. The kind of divisions you talked about were very strong. Almost a neighbouring parish suffered the same problem, but did nothing to the external walls, and there was not a whisper. And pleasing as that is, I think, I think one of the reasons why there may have been such objection was that your community, your predecessors, were, as it were, polluting the external view. And I think that sense of traditionalism, this is what it's always looked like, don't spoil it, can be a very strong, visceral reaction. As I say, you've got far more important things to do than revisit. If you are looking at any continuing issues about ownership of the church by the village community, it would be interesting to know whether there's still any sort of residual feelings about that.
I think there are some people who said that they would never set foot into the drawing room and have in fact done so because they find the conviviality.
Some didn't like the money spent.
Yes. But of course these issues may come up again because the congregation is growing. We're getting at the 10 o'clock service on average 130 people, a lot of young families sending their children to the local church school. And on big festival days, Easter we had 180. I mean, it's a bit of a crush. Mm.
But it would be therefore interesting to know if you attempt anything internally.
Well, I mean, this is the next...
Whether those people who don't at present feel any affinity with the church, whether that problem re-emerges.
Exactly. And I don't think a pint of the bear is going to... going to assuage them very easily.
Do you have to clear graves from that area?
Yes, we did. Yeah, and this
recent graves.
There were 42 recorded dead bodies there.
From the 19th century.
There's probably more underneath.
Right,
yes.
Right. Yeah. So was Eva disinterred and put in a different grave, or are they?
I'm not sure what happened.
If it's just bones rather than whole skeletons, you just normally gather the bones together and put them in a grave and have a burial service over them again.
Yes,
that's
I'm
what
sure
should
what
normally happen. Well, that's what happens in Norfolk. But,
And the new cemetery, where is this to be found? The new cemetery, the existing one in the...
Well, presumably you still bury people in...
Yes, we do. We have two fields beyond what you can see. One is about half full.
You notice it's on the north side, which yesterday they said it's usually the other side, but ours is definitely on the north.
Yeah.
The south has the rectory, you see, which had a previous building.
Can I just ask, how supportive are the community of your project?
I think pretty
We haven't really started off the yes, but we haven't really gone to market yet, as it were.
It, on your sheets of paper, you've got our 3-year plan and what we're hoping to achieve.
One garden open day to raise funds for.
I don't know whether you've got the Holy Trinity Stratford map, the app. You downloaded that. You can download it free if you search for Holy Trinity. You'll find it. But we'd like something like that. In addition to the website, the Spirit of Birth, the website, an app. Where you can take you've got a 360 degree panorama, and can a very useful way of getting around the church without having to pick up a book or bother yourself with a touch screen.
I was very struck by what you said at the beginning about being on the Millennium Way, but people standing outside and not, as it were, feeling they have permission to enter.
Yeah.
This is just a reflection, really, and an acknowledgement that I think there's an unanswered question here, and I don't know what the answer to it is, but in my very urban situation, our church behind the Royal Albert Hall in London could not be more different in its setting than yours. And it is literally on the pavement. That there is a hanging notice board saying, you know, here is a church. When the church doors are open, people stand on the pavement, look in and move on.
Yeah.
We cannot find a way of, as it were, encouraging them in. By the same token, another aspect of this, we have, and again, it couldn't be a greater contrast, we hardly have any resident community around us. The mansion blocks are full of Russian oligarchs these days. But we do have a very strong student and academic population in Imperial College. And over the last few years, I've noted that a number of individuals have popped in at the end of the Sunday morning service when the doors are open, because it's very difficult for us to keep the church open during the week, and have said, I'm in college working today, very unusually, and I have never been able to get in this church, and this is the day that I've made it, and a great sense of rejoicing that they actually finally got through the doors.
Yeah.
And this question of accessibility in this sort of non-physical sense, I think, is a very, very strong problem that we've all got.
Yes. And I think we keep our church open from dawn till dusk. But nevertheless, that response, the cogitation, the wondering whether to go in, and then the last-minute decision not to... I think cries out for explanation.
Well, yes, and I think it is very strong. I totally agree with you on that. I certainly don't know of any ways that one can mitigate it, but I think it is something that ought to be discussed more generally, because I just don't think that any of us have cracked it.
Yes, from Yorkshire, we're having exactly the same issue, and we have a parish room which had also controversies over its construction, partly based on the same issues of money and change and so on. But people are more happy to go into that. Jason is not actually joined on, and so on. It's in the churchyard. And they're happy to go into that. That is a more secular type of space.
Yeah.
So that's where now the mothers and toddlers usually have their service. Occasionally they'll have it in the church, but people are happier to go into there. It's almost like a different constituency.
Yeah.
It's something about the association of the building with perhaps all its layers of history of class domination and elitism and all the rest of it. Actually, that building carries with it. We celebrate its history, but actually it has a history and a whole series of not so nice things, as your examples showed. And in some ways, going into a different space, which has a different, fresh attitude to people, is perhaps... so you may get different people if you just had some of your events just in the in the room. Do you know what I mean? This is the sort of way in which there are potentially other people who are searching, but that building is not the way to access it. So what they want, they look in through the door, but they don't want to go in. But they might go into another sort of thing. You know, so I think that, which is both positive and negative. But there is quite an interesting challenge there, I think.
Whereas other
people who are perhaps appear to be very interested in going in here are in the sort of heritage tourism business. They're not into the sort of searching for other deeper things. So sort of the footfall into the building isn't the same as the other sort of football pool that you might be interested in. And they actually create... So some buildings can seem to be successful. So York Minster has vast numbers of people going in. Most of them come out completely unchanged.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, there's a sort of difference between numbers and...
You don't know, actually, that people coming out of York Minster unchanged.
Some of them are not changed, and a lot of them are not.
By the way, on a quick question, I was very impressed by George Wooden's accounts you were displaying. Are they completely preserved?
They have been all well copied and somewhere it was done. I think the Warwick Records Office had the Chamberlain brothers translate and transcribe, and then some other work was done by a secondary school history master from Warsaw.